Thank you for tuning in to episode 137 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Or follow us on Twitter or Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on PRN.FM. Or download the program after broadcast on iTunes or another podcast program. You can also listen to any of the last 5 episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. phone number 701-719-0990 and follow the instructions. You will be responsible for any long-distance charges. Remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I made by hand using my own photographs, if I'm feeling generous. Maybe 2. If you would like to sponsor this show as an individual or as an advertiser, please contact me. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information you're gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. You can donate via PayPal using the email david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com or go to infectiousmyth.com/donate.php or patreon.com/infectiousmyth if you want to make monthly donations. If you'd like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of on just about any topic, I'd be happy to discuss the opportunity with you. I appreciate you listening, commenting, and suggesting guests. I also appreciate your financial support. And now to today's guest. George Kent is the author of the just-published book, Governments Push Infant Formula. Another recent book of his is Caring About Hunger, published in 2016. George Kent taught at the University of Hawaii, lucky guy, for more than 40 years, retiring as professor emeritus in 2010. He is now associated with both the University of Sydney Department of Peace and Conflict Studies and with the Department of Transformative Social Change at Saybrook University in California. George Kent was also involved with Another Look, along with me, which was an organization founded by Marian Thompson around the year 2000 to investigate the issue of HIV and breastfeeding. Welcome to the show, George.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be in.
So how did a man get involved with studying breastfeeding?
The gender-oriented answer is that I'm not only a man, I'm also a father and grandfather. So that fits into it. But in terms of the more autobiographical answer, I had been studying the problems of malnutrition in the world, widespread hunger, for a long time, at least in the 1990s. And in the process of doing that, I became aware of the massive child mortality worldwide. At the time I was doing the work in the 1990s, about 10 million children were dying before their 5th birthdays each year. So I drilled into that issue because I thought it was amazing and horrible, and amazing not only because of the large number, but also amazing because so few people knew it. And in examining that, I discovered that a very large portion of that is infant mortality. Child mortality is deaths of children under 5 years of age, according to the UN system definition. Infant mortality is deaths of children under 1 year of age. So a lot of the child mortality is infant mortality. And when you dig into that, you discover that many of those deaths are associated with failure to breastfeed the child optimally. In very recent estimates, The Lancet magazine, a distinguished medical journal, published an estimate that currently about 800,000 deaths of infants could be averted each year with better breastfeeding practice.
So how does, I mean, the alternative, and I think what you're talking about is there's a lot of formula feeding occurring even in third world countries. So how does formula result in the deaths of children?
It used to be thought that it was mainly a safety issue.
Like sanitation.
A safety issue related to sanitation. When the big campaigns against infant formula emerged, especially in the 1970s, it was largely about the use of infant formula in low-income countries where there is poor sanitation, poor quality water, and low literacy levels. So people didn't quite understand how to prepare infant formula because it arrived in a powdered form that is not sterile. But now we realize that in high-income countries, those sanitation questions are still there, but not nearly as serious as they are in low-income countries.
Right. To expand. So in a third-world country, you might not have access to clean water, and the water should be boiled before it's used to make formula, and you shouldn't dilute the formula beyond what it's supposed to be, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of issues that go with poverty that make it very difficult to prepare formula according to the instructions on the package, right?
Yeah.
But you're talking about first world countries now where, okay, so you have everything. You got a microwave. You've got clean water coming out of the tap. You've got all the implements. You've got electricity. You've got all of this stuff. So why is that still an issue then?
So now people are beginning to realize more and more that it is not only a safety issue, it's also what we can describe as an adequacy issue. That is, infant formula prepared on the safest possible conditions still will consistently result in worse health outcomes for the infant than breastfeeding. The research shows that very consistently. Feeding with infant formula is not equivalent to breastfeeding, even on the best conditions. And so we find that, in fact, according to many, many studies, that in any population group, in rich countries or poor countries, infants fed with formula have worse health outcomes on a variety of dimensions than those who are breastfeeding, particularly those who are breastfed optimally.
So what are some of the conditions that occur with a distinctly greater frequency in breastfed babies? In formula-fed babies.
There's many health conditions that are worse with infant formula. And the list can begin with mortality. Recent estimates have shown that the United States alone, not breastfeeding or not breastfeeding optimally, is estimated to result about 900 infant deaths each year in the United States. Now, do we think that's trivial, minor, something that can be overlooked as a minor thing? Well, you know, we get excited if we get a defective toy and two children die, and you know, the Food and Drug Administration and the old government get all excited about it. How can we ignore estimated 900 excess deaths a year? And these figures are reliable. Then there's a whole list of diseases, ear infections and so on. And one of the important deficits of infant formula is that it results in worse cognitive skills. That means vision and lower intellectual ability. And this is pretty well documented.
Which you'd think the parents would care about, but I guess the question is, do they know about this?
it's not communicated with nearly enough clarity in user-friendly ways to new parents. And the advertising for infant formula overwhelms what government agencies are prepared to do. And one of the tricks in the infant formula promotion is when they say such and such brand of formula is better in this regard and that regard, they're not very clear about what they're saying. Better than what? Some people take it as meaning better than breastfeeding, which is wrong. When the companies make those claims, they are not very clear, but they're consistently meaning that, well, the version of the formula we're putting out on the market this year is better than what we put out last year.
Right.
And never really acknowledging that what they put out last year was defective.
I was having a discussion with somebody in a completely different domain about marketing, and I was saying whenever I got in with marketing people, I would say to them, you know, what you're proposing to say is not exactly true. And they would say, well, it's not exactly false either. And I would say, well, it's misleading. It's like, well, it's not false. And that's true. Marketing people don't like to overtly lie most of the time. But they sure don't mind if somebody who hasn't really thought through what they're saying draws the wrong conclusion that's beneficial for whatever you're marketing.
And there's nothing accidental about that.
No, it's not accidental at all. I mean, that's why I have a big problem with marketing, because I think it is trying to deliver. It's trying to send a false message, implicitly, not explicitly. Explicitly, it's a true message. Implicitly, what you actually receive internally is actually false, and that's very common with a lot of marketing. Anyway,
right.
One of the big targets for your book is a program called WIC.
Yeah.
And can you first expand the acronym and then tell us what it is and how it relates to formula?
The WIC is an acronym for the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children. WIC comes from the Women and Infants and Children part. And it's a U.S. government program managed through the U.S. Department of Agriculture to provide food and other assistance, educational assistance, for low-income families in the United States. It is, in recent years, it's been funded at a little over $6 billion a year by the federal government. It does a variety of things relating to food, both for infants and particularly, and for the families, through a voucher system.
Is this food stamps?
No, it's separate from food stamps.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Which is now referred to as SNAP, Special Nutrition Assistance Program. It's a parallel program. SNAP and WIC run more or less in parallel.
Right.
As large-scale U.S. federal government programs that provide food assistance. Now, the distinctive thing that interests me about the WIC program is a large part of it, an important part of it, is a program through which they provide infant formula at no cost to the families up to the infant's first year. And they reach about half the infants in the United States, which is a very large proportion.
That shocks me. So you're saying that close to half the infants in the United States are getting free formula for the first year?
Yes.
Oh, that completely blows my mind. Now, what happens after year one?
Then the families have to buy it if they want to use formula. Let me add before.
And how long? I mean, I'm not. It's been a long time since I had little kids, and I've never used formula. My ex, bless her heart, breastfed all three of my children. That's something I have to thank her for a lot. So I had no experience with formula. But how long are babies given formula before they're completely weaned off it?
Let me answer a bigger question. What is optimum breastfeeding? The basic guidelines that come from deep research and clear articulation by major international agencies is that the key element of optimum breastfeeding practice is one, early initiation, meaning breastfeeding should begin within 1 hour after birth. There are important reasons for that.
Right.
Second, breastfeeding should be exclusive for the first 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
That means nothing else.
Like no water.
No water.
No foods. Nothing. Right.
No other liquids. Just breastfeeding.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe some medications if they're indicated by a doctor. But the basic guideline is exclusive breastfeeding, nothing but...
For 6 months, okay.
For 6 months. And then the third part, which answers your question, the recommendation is after that, is continued breastfeeding for up to 2 years and beyond. That means beginning after 6 months, you can begin introducing other foods, so-called complementary foods,
right,
to the diet. So the diet becomes a little more diverse. The child becomes eager to get these other things. They start reaching to dad's plate, and you can't hold her back.
Right.
But breastfeeding along with other foods can go on well beyond 2 years, three, sometimes even 4 years. The general advice is that you let the child decide.
Right. Okay, so you're hooked, right? You've had free formula for a year. Now you're kind of under stress economically. If you need to be buying formula, which is not cheap, beyond 1 year.
Well, let me say a little bit more about the economics
mm-hmm.
of the program, because I don't think most people quite understand why and how it is that they're getting all this free formula. Some people worry that the taxpayers are having to pay a lot of money for this, because they see on the retail stores that infant formula can be very expensive, especially the well-known brand names.
Mm-hmm.
So the way the economics work is this, that the U.S. government does indeed buy the product. There's a bidding process by the companies. And so the U.S. government does pay for the product. But it's important to know also that the manufacturers, the suppliers, then give the government a rebate of around 90% of the cost. So really, the government is only paying a tiny fraction of the retail cost or even the wholesale cost.
Okay, so the government is getting a formula for 10% of the retail price or something like that.
Yeah, close to that.
But of course, if the markup is 200%, then the formula companies could still be at least breaking even on this.
Yeah, but that's the wrong, I believe the wrong way of thinking about it.
Okay, tell me how to think about this.
First of all, when there's an increase in price of formula, the manufacturers don't get the retail price that is paid for the formula people buy in the supermarket. The manufacturers, you know, the supermarket gets the difference between the wholesale and the retail prices. So what's going on is this, that you need to have an analytical framework that goes through time. Yes, it looks like a bad deal for the formula companies if they're only getting a tiny fraction perception of the value of the product. And the explanation I'm offering is that what we're running here is what I call an addiction model. Free samples. I don't know if you remember, but I remember when I was much younger, the tobacco companies used to hand out these little packets of four cigarettes free on airplanes and in a variety of public spaces. They were giving out free cigarettes. They would have people, you know, to do that. And what's the reason for this? They are trying to win over people not only to smoking, but also to their particular brand. It's important to notice that when the WIC program invites bids for to supply formula to the program, it is only the well-known brands that bid, not the manufacturers of generic formula or so-called store brands,
right,
the lower-priced product.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that, in my analysis, is that the people that produce the generic forms don't have an interest in winning brand loyalty. They don't have an income stream that comes to them from future sales.
Well, there is no brand loyalty to a generic product, right? I mean, you go to the store and you buy the no-name brand because it's cheapest, and if the no-name brand is the most expensive thing on the shelf, you're probably not going to buy it unless you just kind of assume it's cheaper. But when you find out, for example, if you found out that a brand name was half the price on special of a no-name brand, you'd probably say, great, I can get a brand name for less than the no-name. Right? I don't think it's any brand loyalty, whereas the other way around, it's like, I buy the best for my kid.
And generally, that the assumption is that it's a well-known brand that is the best quality.
Mm-hmm.
And so what the manufacturers are gaining through this deal with the WIC program is they're getting the government to serve as the distributors of free samples, which will affect the buying behavior not only for after the first year when the free supply stops coming from WIC, but also after they leave the WIC program, and many leave the program after the first year. And also, it's been shown that the winning the WIC contract results in increased retail prices of that brand in the general market. So it results in increased prices for consumers, whether or not they're in the WIC program.
Yeah, I mean, if I had a desired profit margin and I was going to give half my product away, if I had the ability to double my price, I would just do that and I'd get my profits in the second year. I mean, it's a strange business model. But like, I think your point is that, you know, if you don't breastfeed right away, you don't have a second chance.
Yeah, that's an important part of the calculation here. Some people might go into it thinking, I'll use formula when it's free, and then I'll breastfeed after that. Well, if you've been breastfeeding, when a woman breastfeeds, especially for an extended period of time, her capacity to restart breastfeeding is sharply diminished.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a factor here as well. It's not just a spigot that can be turned on and off easily. With good support from a lactation counselor, it is often possible to restart lactation long after the birth of the child, but not easy.
I don't see that as something that a lot of people would do, and it would be even more difficult if you were poor, because who's going to pay for the lactation consultant?
And let me add, though, although the research is not solid on this, there are reasons to think that getting children started on infant formula is kind of a gateway into a lifetime of highly processed food.
Mm. And I presume some of the formula brands are big names in food production in general.
Well, and it it's a steady chain. You have the particular brand that you favored because you got it for the first year. Then you get additional infant formula. Then you get so-called starter formula, then starter food in various packaged
right.
forms. And it's a continuum for the big companies.
The formula to fat pipeline.
So if you can lock in the commitment to a particular brand from day one, you've got a gold mine. So you see, if you do your economic calculations about the merit of the contract, but only look at the short term, you're missing.
Right. A couple more things about WIC, which are addressed at length in your book, Governments Push Infant Formula, WIC being a government program pushing infant formula. Does WIC give any support to women who wish to breastfeed?
Yes, very definitely. They have a vigorous program, although somewhat uneven across the country because the different WIC offices have some independence in how they operate. But WIC, in general, does indeed have a breastfeeding support program. So those who make the choice to breastfeed get extra food, they get support from lactation counselor, and so on. One point on which WIC is weak, as far as I'm concerned, is they are not doing an adequate job of assuring that new parents have good information for making the choice between breastfeeding and formula feeding.
Mm-hmm.
And there's that tipping point. So WIC historically has taken the position of saying, well, we're just doing what the mothers want. We choose, you know, they choose. We don't choose, and we're all innocent in this.
Right, we're just a neutral party. You decide what you want, and we'll give it to you.
But if I'm giving you free formula for a year, which the mom knows has considerable economic value, from seeing the prices at the supermarket, you know, that's got to be read as an inducement to use formula.
Can you describe the time when you were invited to give a talk at WIC and got censored, canceled?
That was in 2011. Now, let me give a bit of background. WIC, there's a national WIC association and a variety of regional WIC associations. And
mm-hmm.
my dealings then were with the California WIC Association. And I'll describe that in a moment. But let me say first that these WIC associations are not government agencies. They're non-governmental, funded partly with by the food industry. And they do a lot to lobby for and support the WIC program, mm-hmm. program. In my view, they allow many people to believe that they are government agencies and mm-hmm. have the credibility that goes along with that. So that's part of the background that we need to know here. So the California WIC Association invited me to give a talk at their major annual meeting. And, you know, we had some back and forth about what I will talk about because they knew generally that I had been studying formula issues and infant feeding issues more broadly. And I was in the written program. I had my hotel air ticket. My hotel room was booked, and I had communicated to them that I was going to have some critical things to say about WIC's formula distribution program, along the lines of what I've just said. And they disinvited me just days before the event.
Well, didn't you also said in your book that they they gave you some talking points that you could use instead?
Yeah. They suggested various points of praise.
That is the shocking thing to me. I mean, being censored, that's bad. But when you try to put words into someone's mouth that are clearly not what that person thinks, I mean, that's even worse than censorship. I mean, that's outright propaganda.
And we have to look at this together with some of the so-called research studies that have been designed to assess WIC as a government program. And, you know, to most people, they would first be too technical and barely readable. But for people who have an understanding of how to read technical research and know what the issues are, a lot of those assessments are quite skewed to favor the program and thus win a bump up in funding from the Congress.
Would you describe WIC as a subsidy to the agricultural industry, which produces the milk from which the formula is produced?
Yes. I think, in fact, I think that's part of the explanation of why, historically, the WIC program became lodged in the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Why isn't it in the Department of Health?
That struck me immediately when you said that this rings, this sounds very much like a subsidy to the milk manufacturers, which is interesting because in America, where the sort of the free market's supposed to rule and everybody's always saying lower taxes, get the government out of my business, but quietly behind the scenes, these big corporations are taking massive subsidies from...
Well, everyone knows about the big corporations, and you know the criticism of them is sort of well known. But there needs to be a critical look at the role of government as well. I did a book in 2011 called "Regulating Infant Formula," and I took the government to task, particularly the Food and Drug Administration, for not doing the regulating it's supposed to do. I mean, if they, just to give a quick example, if they want to know if their product is safe, they ask the manufacturer, is it safe? And they say yes.
That surprises me.
That's the type of monitoring we have. Is your infant formula nutritionally adequate? Oh, yes, it is. It meets nutritional... This goes back to the question we talked about a few minutes ago. The view of nutritional adequacy based on the regulations that prevail is you have to have a certain list of ingredients. And if you have the list of ingredients, you have a good food product for the child.
Well, any country that relies on the four food groups, which I guess I'm talking about Canada and the U.S., and probably other countries, I mean, has dumbed down the whole concept of nutrition, because clearly nutrition is a lot more complicated than just, you know, the four groups. And even if there's a list of ingredients, it's still not enough, right? I mean, how many compounds are there in human breast milk?
Well, the estimates keep coming out in terms of larger and larger numbers.
Right.
But my argument is that to think a list of ingredients will somehow give you the product you're hoping to have is like saying a Rembrandt painting is no different from a can of blue paint, yellow paint, and red paint.
I can give you the list of ingredients for Shakespeare, It's the letters A through Z.
Right. Or another one I use in my writing about this is, you know, it's like putting some plastic and rubber and glass and metal into a bag, shaking it up and thinking you're going to get a car.
Yes. I had a car that like that once, but I won't tell you the brand name.
but the line of thinking that the specific, it's sufficient to meet the list of ingredients.
Mm.
And that somehow is equivalent or even close to equivalent is just dead wrong. And you see, this point has nothing to do with safety questions. One of the very important components of the book that people should notice the government's push in front of the first chapter, it talks about how infant formula regularly leads to worse health outcomes than breastfeeding. But then in the last chapter of the book, I ask, why is that? Why is that pattern there? And what I argue is that there's a failure to recognize that breast milk is like living tissue. It's alive, and the breastfeeding process is based on active communication between the infant and the child. So if the infant is sick, for example, the composition of the breast milk changes. It adapts to it.
There's two very important points there, is that, first of all, the contact between the mother and the child, not just with the breast, but the mother having to hold the child, but with the breast as well, plus the fact that there are living cells in the breast milk, is something that cannot be properly replicated by formula. Even, you know, parents will obviously hold the baby in their arms when they're feeding formula, but the contact of the breast and the suckling of a living being, the mother, is psychologically and physically very important.
And we should point out that breastfeeding is also shown to have significant benefits for the mother's health.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of those?
Particularly cancer.
Breast cancer.
Breast cancer. And I think some other cancers. There's a list of other issues.
I had heard that it also helps the uterus return to its normal size, so the mother's waistline shrinks more
and
quickly.
And also breastfeeding helps to prevent new pregnancies for a time.
Yes. And there's a psychological impact, the sort of the endorphins that are produced by the child's suckling.
Let me come back for a moment to the differences between the manufactured product and the natural product.
Right.
On the cover of the book, Government's Push Infant Formula, and you can see these covers on the Amazon. You know, the book is available on Amazon, and the website for the book allows you to see the cover, back and front covers. And the front cover is a slide I first saw at a conference, which has a magnified view of breast milk on the left, which is a series of, you know, fat bubbles you can see it.
Mm-hmm.
Still picture, unfortunately. And on the right is what looks like beach sand or something like that. And as I say in the text in the last chapter, that stuff on the right looks like an industrial product, and that's because it is. And on the back cover, I have another picture from a woman who was amazed at her own breast milk having two different colors at two different stages. And she realized that this meant it was adapting to the current conditions of the child.
Mm-hmm.
And some people have, you know, simply waxed poetic about this amazing wisdom of breastfeeding.
Yeah, and even though science would love to understand this, there's probably parts of this that are way beyond our current understanding.
Yeah.
And sometimes things are not susceptible to a reductionist analysis.
Exactly.
In your book, you specifically talk about Chile and Egypt. You obviously spend a lot of time talking about the United States. So Why Chile and Egypt in the context of formula feeding?
Well, two reasons. One is that I managed to find suitable contacts in those two countries who would work with me on this. Both of those chapters are based in articles that we published earlier in an online open access journal called Social Medicine. And so any listeners can look that up online, Social Medicine. And these were published last year and this year. But the real filter is this. I was interested in editing countries that do large-scale distribution of highly subsidized or free infant formula. And those two countries came to the top of my list. There are others who do some things on a smaller scale, like Argentina and the UK. Britain provides some formula through its programs, but none of them are on the scale that you find in U.S., Egypt, and Chile.
I mean, Chile is kind of a second world country. I mean, if you can still use those outdated terms, I mean, it's a fairly modern country. A lot of people have a significant income, but Egypt has a massive number of poor people. So what's the impact of a free formula program in a country like Egypt?
Egypt, unfortunately, has a long commitment to subsidized food for the general population. As a result, a kind of overall addiction to free food, which is, I think, a big policy mistake on the part of government, to think it's up to government to feed the people. People get used to the idea. And then the formula thing just went along for the ride as part of that. In terms of these governments, food distribution programs in many countries result in a great deal of corruption and waste and terribly distorted diets.
Right.
Because they tend to support the cheapest foods resulting from the most politically active producers, and they're not driven by a good sense of diet and health. And researching it shows that the reasoning for doing this large-scale distribution of formula is not very good, certainly in the health dimension. What they would benefit from more is much better breastfeeding support programs and solve many problems with that. That reminds me, I want to go back to the point we discussed a few minutes ago about WIC having breastfeeding support program, and I acknowledge that it does. But in my book, I do some estimating to get a sense of what is the scale of the formula distribution program with the scale of the breastfeeding promotion program. And obviously there's several different ways of estimating that. If I use the retail value of the formula, I come to the conclusion that the value, from the point of view of the WIC participant, that the value of the formula distribution program is about 60 times as much as the money value of the
breastfeeding
support program. So,
what are breastfeeding? The target for WIC is towards the poorer end of the economic spectrum. What are the rates of breastfeeding among poorer women in America?
They are generally low. WIC sometimes puts out information to suggest that it's high, but it's sometimes misleading. the primary target indicator for the analysis of breastfeeding patterns is exclusive breastfeeding to around 6 months.
Right.
So if you count the number at, say, 5 months, you've got a pretty good indicator of it. But WIC has a habit of saying, oh, we've got 80% breastfeeding rate. Well, but there they're talking about initiation.
Oh, 80% initiate breastfeeding.
Yeah. But they tend not to be as clear as they should be. You know, that they got a misleading indicator.
Right. I mean, would you say that breastfeeding rates amongst poor people in America are lower than amongst middle-class women? Is there data on that?
Yes. And that's largely due to WIC. We say that WIC is designed to provide for needy people. Well, can we say that half the infants in the United States are needy? That they need subsidized food? I mean, that seems a kind of a stretch.
Yeah, I mean, what's the basis for deciding whether or not you qualify for WIC?
There's several. If you're within 185% of the official poverty line or are under certain other programs, such as the SNAP program, which used to be called food stamps. So there's a variety of ways to get on WIC.
Right.
And it goes beyond, the list goes beyond what I've just named.
I mean, so, it's kind of interesting because we've just had a debate in the United States about healthcare, and it seems to me that the conservatives in the United States are saying pretty clearly that, you know, you shouldn't be getting free healthcare unless you're desperately poor. They're not talking about 185% of the poverty line.
Yeah. So, I want to distinguish between critical assessment of the WIC program taken as a whole and the formula subpart of it, which is what my criticism focuses on. I agree that generally WIC does a good job to help people deal with their food insecurity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not sure where they're going to get their food and how they're going to get food. And WIC, in its general food package, does some good things to put emphasis on healthier whole food. So I still have doubts that there's any compelling reason to cover half the infants in the United States. Also, I think there's no reason for WIC to actively promote the use of formula. And I talk about possibilities for phasing out the formula subsidy. You want to do things like they do in Britain. They say to families that here you have a voucher for X dollars worth of food, and you can go to these designated markets and spend it on a variety of things, including infant formula. There's no particular separate subsidy for infant formula. But here's the WIC program having a very special subsidy, 100% subsidy, for infant formula. While many other agencies of government and many other non-governmental organizations are advocating breastfeeding, there's just no reason in the world for the government to be pushing formula.
I think a lot of this comes down to the American attitude towards breasts, and they're seen as, on women anyway, I mean, men can walk around on the beach with their chest bare, but I remember Marian Thompson, who I interviewed on this show, saying the time, you know, she was asked to go breastfeed in the toilet.
Yeah.
Because it's something you should do, you know, nobody should have to see that. Whereas in most countries in the world, I mean, you're at dinner and the baby's crying, the woman picks up the baby, sticks it on the breast, and nobody, yeah. you know, does anything about it. And that seems to be more, at least as important as learning what the benefits of breastfeeding are in terms of the baby's health and the mother's health, is just getting over this sort of innate sense that women's breasts are shameful and have to be held, withheld from public viewing.
It brings two themes to mind. One is about a woman, you know, in a shopping mall, breastfeeding, sitting on a bench, and some man comes over and grumbles about it. And she says to her, well, if this troubles you, here's a blanket. Feel free to put it over your head.
Yes, that would solve the problem.
Now, there's another point I want to open up for discussion, maybe not today, but I'm trying to open it up in the world, if you like. There are huge numbers of lactating women around in every community who would be quite willing to breastfeed infants of other women if they really can't or won't breastfeed their own.
Something happened recently in Canada where a woman talked about a time when she breastfed somebody else's child without the mother's permission or something. Maybe the baby was being fussy and she like picked it up and slapped the baby on the breast and it shut up, you know, it stopped crying because it was hungry. But I think there's sort of a feeling that there's something horribly unsanitary about, you know, if breastfeeding is okay, it's tolerable, but, you know, to put another child, a child on a breast of somebody other than the mother, there seems to be some sense of danger, it's unsanitary or something, but it doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
While in many low-income countries, that attitude is just bizarre.
Right.
Because in the normal course of events, infants get passed around casually.
Right, right.
And so I would say what I'm interested in is, can we free up the attitude, the idea of providing, well, either direct breastfeeding or otherwise providing human milk to infants of other women. And I think if, in fact, I in the book I advocate that WIC explore breast milk, human milk banking vigorously. And also, I think in emergency situations, instead of having several good-hearted charitable NGOs try to send in infant formula, why don't we encourage lactating women in the area to open themselves to feeding other women? In the Philippines, there's an organized group that is prepared to do that, to go into emergency situations and breastfeed as needed.
I remember there was a big earthquake in China, I guess this maybe in the mid-2000s. I think this might have been the Chengdu earthquake. And they pulled an infant out of the rubble, and a police woman just opened up her shirt and put the baby on her breast because she was lactating.
Yeah.
And that was just a maternal instinct. The mother was probably dead. What else are you going to do? But in America, that could cause like huge social upset, right? How could you do this?
But think about if you organize, and I'm thinking here more of the low-income countries,
mm-hmm.
where the child mortality is very high. Why not encourage that sort of breastfeeding, at least for emergency situations?
Yeah, no, it all makes sense. I'd like to talk about this more, but we've kind of run out of time for our conversation. So I'll give you one more closing remark, and then we're going to have to wrap up.
I'd encourage people to look at lulu.com, lulu.com. It's the publisher of the book. They can find that book of mine and also another called Caring About Hunger that came out last year, they are also available on Amazon. And so I encourage having a look at the descriptions there, and of course, if you're interested, buy it. But if not, at least look at the cover pictures.
Right, so if you're interested in food security or breastfeeding issues, then George Kent has two interesting books to read. So I encourage people in those categories to go out and get them. And George, thank you very much for joining me today.
Glad to do it. Thanks for inviting me.
Okay, goodbye.
Bye-bye.
As you probably figured out, I love data, and I don't like people who manipulate data. And when people talk about immigrant crime, they're implying that crime amongst immigrants is a bigger problem amongst citizens. Or they're perhaps saying that we should only bring in immigrants if we could guarantee that none of them would be criminals already or would become criminals coming into the country, and that's obviously impossible. So when I made a few points on a blog about this, I got this following response. I don't think I need to say anything about it. I'll just read it straight. David, you are un-American and a traitor and a shill and a liar. Racism has nothing to do with protecting our most vulnerable, precious people. You are also an idiot and a sick individual. You are probably a paid troll from the pizza crowd who supports pedophiles by whining. You should leave America and take the rest of the filth to the Mideast or Venezuela, where you will be a lot more comfortable. Have you ever been to El Paso or Juarez? It's a shithole, and white people did not make it that way. Mexico is an extremely corrupt country, and the women and children and many of the men are treated despicably by the gangs that are infiltrating America, thanks to Obama. If it was up to me, I would take all the pedophilia deniers and perpetrators and ship them off immediately to a Muslim country, because that is where you all belong. These are heinous crimes against humanity, and this is the bottom line of filth that all these criminals going after Trump are protecting. The U.S. had no business bombing and invading countries that they have and destabilizing governments. That said, many cultures choose to be violent and disgusting despite billions of dollars thrown at them in aid. Mr. Johnson, who is a man, I believe, in North Carolina, who says that immigrant crime is a big problem, deserves our support, accolades, donations, and help. We all need to do our part to remove this evil from our world. Write your representatives, sheriffs, anyone you can. Demand adherence to our Constitution circa 1791. Thank you for listening to episode 137 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. And follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Infectious Myth. You can commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.